Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Dan Clayton.
And I'm Jill Lavender.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Lexis. Today we are talking about all things environmental, sustainability, climate change, how that links to metaphor. And we're going to start today with Lang in the News before we come on to our interview with Aaron Stibbe, an eco-linguist. So let's start with the fact that as we are recording today, we are just coming to the end of COP27. You know, environmental activism is in the news. The idea of growing economies or stunting economies with environmental policy. Greenwashing is in the news. There's a lot going on. So let's start off with a couple of Lang in the News stories. Let's start with a piece from The Conversation that is about the Just Stop Oil protesters and is having a look at how they use language in comparison to politicians. Dan, Yeah. Do you want to talk about this one?
It's by Claire Cunningham, who's a linguist at York St John University. And she talks about some corpus analysis they've done, looking at the different sort of keywords that are used by politicians and activists. And on the kind of surface of it, I suppose it's a fairly obvious conclusion, isn't it? Is that activists talk about it using different kind of themes to the politicians. And there's no great surprise that the kind of language they're using, the kind of keywords, and we'll come back to that thing about keywords and what they are in a sec, but the sort of keywords I identify, things like, for the activists, it's words like activism, climate justice, climate action. They talk about nature, they talk about people, and particularly around sort of agency, I think, isn't it? People doing things to the planet. They talk a lot about kind of human rights around people's rights to have clean drinking water and a climate that sustains them rather than destroys them. And then you get the politicians on the other side who are basically using language that is much more to do with finance, economy, and the energy industry, which is, no great surprise.
So we've got words like industry, finance, decarbonize, underinvestment, constituent, whereas the activists are talking about human responsibility and human agency in making positive change. Political language is focused on investment, economic growth, tying environmental issues to the local economy in which it operates.
I think what struck me was the different ways that they talk about people. So with the activists talking about people in terms of their kind of human rights, whereas when you do get any reference to people with the politicians, they're referred to as bill payers. So it's a different kind of slant, really, on who humans are and what's important to them, I think.
It's worth talking about where they got this information from. So when we talk about the keywords, like, how did they compile the data?
Yeah, so they talk about this in the article. They say about how they created two corpora, and one curated politicians talk about the climate from the House of Commons from 2013 to 20, and the other one was from activists' language on YouTube videos from 2019 to 20. And I think they say in the article they're about 30,000 words each. And then the thing with the keywords is quite interesting, because they then kind of use corpus software to kind of compile a list of keywords. And the keywords are the words that occur in their corpus more often than they occur in general use. So they do a sort of comparison with a corpus. And I think they talk about using the English Web 2018 corpus. So it's basically to kind of see, is there more of a tendency for certain words to appear in their corpus than in the one that they're using as their kind of reference point? And that then becomes a kind of, you know, keyword they can investigate. It's quite a nice kind of methodology for students to think about, isn't it, that one?
Yeah, for definite. And I think corpus linguistics is such a nice way into kind of the numerically based and slightly more scientific end of quantitative analysis of language that'll really appeal to some students. I mean, it really puts others off, and that's totally okay as well. You know, if you're into quantitative data, then this is quite a nice way to do language analysis, at least as a starting point, even though you may come on and then talk about more qualitative themes that come out, which of course is what the linguists do, and that's what gives us this idea about quite disparate discourses emerging. But that brings us on quite nicely to kind of the secondary strand of this, which is the idea of linking local economy and global economy to environmental issues, because that brings us into something else that we've noticed as sort of an emergent thread in the news over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, there's been a few stories about this, about how the economy should be kind of represented. And when we come on to the interview with Aaron Stibbe later on, he talks a bit about some of the kind of metaphors for the economy and how there's kind of a conflict between, you know, the things that are good for the planet and the things that are good for the economy, you know, so sort of money making versus the future of life on Earth. And there is this sort of sense in which there's at least been some sort of challenge, I think, to the way in which the economy is represented in the media. And so things like the description of a fiscal black hole, or using the kind of metaphor of kind of household finances to describe the kind of national economy. So you sometimes get kind of people talking about how, you know, if there's a big deficit and the country's in debt, that we've maxed out our credit card, or we've maxed out our overdraft. And there's a lot of kind of kickback against that from a lot of economists and political thinkers, because it's suggesting that really there is no comparison between family household finances and the economy, because governments can make their own money. They can generate their own money. And it's not like the situation that, you know, most individuals are in, that they have to kind of, you know, they can't just kind of go off and generate and make 5,000 pound coins. So there's some interesting things about how all of that's been sort of framed, and, you know, how certain ways of kind of using language to represent the economy might misrepresent what's actually going on.
We've got quite a nice BBC news article here that we'll post in the show notes. The headline is "Economists Question, Quote, Black Hole in UK Finances." And they do seem to be questioning, A, the underpinning assumption that there is a black hole, but also the representation of it as this big black, you know, inescapable thing that sort of looms just sort of above us. They said that fiscally, actually, it's false on basic economic terms, but also they disagree with the representation of it as this, you know, inescapable event.
Yeah, it's a political choice, isn't it?
And it's quite a powerful metaphor, isn't it? Because generally, if you think about a hole, it's something that needs to be filled. You've got to take action. If it's a black hole, then you're going to have to take quite drastic action. Mm. And I think here, the drastic action that's suggested is kind of higher taxes and more cuts and more austerity. Mm. So it's a way of justifying political choices that is quite persuasive, I think.
Yeah, and that's literally what it says in the opening line of the article. A group of economists have questioned UK assertions that a black hole in the public finances will need to be filled with austerity measures and tax rises.
One of the things that metaphors do really well is try and take concepts, difficult like concepts, and make them more tangible in a way. But then in doing that, you run the risk of kind of misrepresenting the concept in the first place. And I'm wondering whether that's what the economists are suggesting is happening here.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it?
And we definitely saw that with the COVID metaphors that we've discussed previously. We've seen it with medical metaphors that we've also discussed previously. The whole concept of metaphor as fact, particularly in public discourse and kind of institutions of power like the government, relaying senses of reality via metaphors that they've chosen or constructed themselves, is a particularly interesting one for us to look at and be cognizant of as we're reading the news, and that students should be as well. So really, really lovely kind of thing to have a look at with students as part of their linguistic analysis.
Yeah, and it ties into what we talk about in another episode where we interview Katie Brown and we talk about discourses around immigration and metaphors for migration. So it'd be worth having a listen to that episode as well. Okay, so we're really pleased to welcome Aaron Stibbe today, who is Professor in Ecological Linguistics at University of Gloucestershire and is the author of Ecolinguistics, Language, Ecology and the Stories We Live By. So welcome to Lexis, Aaron.
Oh, thanks very much for inviting me.
So Aaron, can we get things clear from the outset? When you talk about the eco bit of ecolinguistics, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's ecology in the normal scientific sense of the word, which is the interactions of organisms with other organisms and the physical environment. But there's a couple of extra things to add to that. That is, when people think of ecology, they usually just think about animals and plants and forests and rivers. But every ecosystem on Earth has some kind of human influence in it as well. So we're definitely including the human in this. So we could say it's the interactions of humans with other species and the physical environment. And the other thing to add is that humans have language. And so language is also part of ecology because it's how we interact with each other.
I mean, I find that really interesting that you're kind of zooming out to include, you know, the whole world in a way that we often don't. We think about it being other, don't we? Mm. We're the human race and we're the central species and then it's all out there. But I think your work makes that clear that we're only that part of it and that we need to be thinking about that balance.
And so in your introduction to ecolinguistics, you say that ecolinguistics is about critiquing forms of language that contribute to ecological destruction and aiding in the search for new forms of language that inspire people to protect the natural world. And that's a quote from the introduction. Would you then say that ecolinguistics is maybe as much a form of social campaigning as it is a branch of linguistics?
Yeah, I would probably use the word movement. So ecolinguistics is a movement which has just got one clear message. And that message is, when you're doing linguistics, don't forget about animals, plants, forests, rivers, and the ecosystems that life depends on. Because if you forget about those, well, firstly, you're not being very accurate because language is always within the context of humans and the more than human world. And the more than human world influences language. And the way we use language has an influence on nature and the natural world. The other thing is, if you ignore everything other than the human, then you're not going to be able to use linguistics to deal with some of the major challenges that we face of ecological destruction, of ecological justice, of war and migration and coronavirus and all of these things that result from the same underlying cause. And we have to think wider than just the human if we're going to try to deal with some of these big issues.
And as part of that then, so you kind of think about clearly the sort of bigger picture, and as Jill was saying, the sort of relationship between humans and our place in the ecosystem, if you like. Where does kind of language fit into that, do you think? Where's the important kind of role for language in all of that?
Yeah, well, some people are a bit surprised at first because it's like language on one side and ecology on the other side.
Mm.
But the two are intimately related because how we treat the natural world depends on how we think about the natural world.
Right. Yeah.
And the messages we get, which influence our thinking, come through language.
Mm.
So in ecolinguistics, we might look at advertising and how it encourages us to buy all of this unnecessary, environmentally destructive stuff, yeah. Maybe having to go into debt and do jobs that we hate to buy all of this stuff. And all of this to kind of feed a capitalist economy rather than actually benefiting us or the world. So we might look at the language of advertising, language of economics, but then equally we might look at nature writing, how it might inspire us to protect and care about the natural world.
So if you had to sum it up, what would you say is the most important in linguistic idea in your book, Aaron?
Well, this would definitely be the stories we live by. And I have in the past talked about discourses and ideologies, but that doesn't really hit home with people. But the idea that our civilization is based on stories and these stories are putting us on a path towards ecological collapse, that really grabs people. But the best thing is this search for new stories to live by, that we could fundamentally rethink our civilization and build a new ecological civilization and based on different stories. So I'd say that's the key part of the book.
Mm, we've talked on the podcast before about the importance of narratives, was the word that we've used before, but I'm interested in this, in the word stories particularly. I really like that. So what are the most important stories, do you think, that ecolinguistics can help us understand?
Yeah, so there are lots of terms like story and narrative and meta-narrative. And these are kind of the fundamental basis of our thoughts within our culture. So some of the big ones that are really influential are things about the economy. So the story that economic growth is the goal of society. And recently, the leader of the Labour Party was using the expression growth, growth, growth as the goals of society. Not just that, but the Conservative Prime Minister was also using exactly those same terms, growth, growth, growth. And I haven't mentioned their specific names because they keep changing all the time. And then also associated with that is this story that low retail sales are bad. So whenever the sales of a particular product go down, then that's represented as something very negative. So for example, when the sales of diesel cars started to fall, you would expect that to be something positive. Diesel cars are very polluting and they kill thousands of people every year. But when diesel car sales started to go down, the newspapers started representing them in a very negative thing. They used words like slumping, decline, short-sighted, backlash, disappointing, plummeted, hampered, frustration, consternation, confusion. So this is what I call an appraisal pattern. So this is a pattern of negativity that you find in the newspapers around the sales of any product going down. And this is something quite useful for A-level, because in A-level, you're often asked to compare one thing or another thing, or compare two texts. And if you talk about the appraisal patterns, the general patterns of how things are represented as positive or negative, then you can get some insights, because psychologically, we tend to think of things positively or negatively in a kind of a simplistic way. So that's appraisal patterns. Then we've got stories about nature being a machine, stories about eating meat being masculine.
Mm.
We've even got like the story in the weather forecast that sunny weather is good. And like all the time, even in the middle of a heat wave, sunny weather is, it's fantastic, beautiful, gorgeous weather out there. But the climate is changing. And if it's 40 degrees, as it was earlier, this is not actually good news, because climate is changing. And then any kind of rain or mist or fog gets presented as disappointing weather, gloomy, dreary, dull weather. And you might think that's just like a really trivial story in our society. But then you've got all the travel agents who are like saying, escape from British weather and fly off to the sun.
Yeah.
You get a situation where people spend most of the year indoors escaping from this gloomy weather outside rather than going out and enjoying the natural world around them. And then flying off on jets, which use masses of fossil fuels, for a couple of weeks in the sun. So these are the kinds of stories that we might look at in ecolinguistics.
And you mentioned the kind of representation of weather and the reporting of the you know, the sort of heat wave thing. I've always kind of thought of it as a bit like the kind of few what a scorcher kind of narrative that we get in the British press, where, you know, your front pages are absolutely covered in like sunbathing, usually kind of women, if it's the sun and the star, for example. You get pictures of kind of packed beaches. And as you say, this sort of discourse of positivity around heat waves. But you even get that with what appears to be kind of, you might imagine, would be more intelligent, educated, more kind of meteorologically literate presenters, like the weather forecasters, who seem to take a sort of satisfaction in telling us going to reach, you know, heights of, you know, 38 degrees tomorrow. I mean, why are people like that actually kind of celebrating climate collapse as well?
Well, and the reason is because these stories are very deeply embedded in our culture and embedded in our minds. And it's very hard to go beyond that, because that's our automatic response. And so when I'm listening to the news and it's like economic growth has gone up, then I immediately get this positive feeling. Okay, that's good. But then I know that economic growth is also associated with environmental destruction. And often economic growth actually benefits the very rich while exploiting the poor even more, because they have to work even harder. But I have this automatic reaction because of the culture that I'm in and the stories I've heard throughout my life, that I just feel positive about it. And then I have to think, oh, well, yes, actually, maybe this isn't what we need right now. Maybe we need more well-being rather than more money changing hands.
Yeah. And is there a basic problem as well? I mean, in that sort of up-down metaphor kind of sense, where up is good, down is bad. If the temperature is going up, I mean, maybe what we need to do is turn the thermometer on its side. And actually, then when the temperature goes up, it's not really going up. We don't feel that kind of happiness.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. And it's the same with sales going up. And it's like, yeah, sales are going up. It's hard to celebrate sales going down or declining, because that automatically sounds negative. And this is a problem quite deep in the human brain. We align things with positivity and negativity. Something like fast is positive and slow is negative.
Right, yeah.
And this is the marked terms. So some terms in English like fast are marked, and then terms like slow are unmarked. Convenient, inconvenient. So people talk about mowing the lawn as inconvenient, and so we need to have plastic grass, for instance.
Right.
And we've got this model of convenience, but it's not necessarily a model that serves us very well.
It's strange, isn't it? Because it is about having more of something very often, isn't it? If something's going up, people feel they're having more of something. But what we sometimes need more of is rain to fill the reservoirs. You know, why can't that be a going, you know, more rain? If we could only, as you say, reframe our thinking to think that sometimes in a water shortage, more rain is still a more, is still going up, it's still a positive thing.
Oh, absolutely. And that goes across everything, really, because we tend to think that we need more and more stuff. Well, actually, we do need more. We need more friendships. We need more time spent in nature. We need more sharing. And so if we could just focus on the things we need more of that aren't destroying the environment, that would be great.
And that sort of leads on to another question, really, which is about the kind of kickback there's been against what green policies there have been. And I mean, that's not even to say that there are many useful green policies put forward by many governments, but we're recording this as COP27 starts and lots of international leaders are meeting up to talk about climate change and discussing things to do with the environment. But a lot of those governments and a lot of the international media kind of kicks back against anything that is seen to be creating inconvenience, restricting people's lives in some way. And again, you see that sort of narrative emerging, don't you, of that those kind of negative factors about green policies. So what do we kind of do with that? How do we respond to those kind of anti-green narratives, do you think?
Well, I think that this is where we need to go really into the heart of the stories that our industrial civilization is based on and challenge those stories right at the root. So to give you an example of that, I've looked at economics textbooks and the kind of language that they use in the textbooks. And the kind of language, some quotes from some economics textbooks, more is better than less. Consumers always prefer more of any good to less. Consumers are never satisfied or satiated. More is always better. And these kinds of statements tell a particular story. And that is the story that humans are fundamentally selfish. And I think we've built a whole society around this idea that humans are selfish and greedy, and we have to harness that greed to accomplish the goals of society. But the more that we say that humans are selfish, the more it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People do actually become selfish. And then, of course, we've got the advertising, which really encourages us to become this selfish consumer who's never satisfied. And so the thing we need to do is to challenge that story at its heart. So I have a quotation from Caroline Lucas, who is the UK's only Green MP. And she said during the pandemic, she said, "For decades, our political leaders have told us we are greedy, selfish, and out for ourselves, and that this is the natural order of things. Many of us had even begun to believe it. But today we have shown this to be a lie. In a crisis, we pull together." And she's talking here about during the pandemic when people came together to help each other. And then she carries on with, "Despite the danger and fear and terrible sadness caused by this pandemic, we can now finally demolish the miserable mythology of human selfishness." So here we have Caroline Lucas, who is calling out this story for what it is, a story. Now, stories are not necessarily untrue, but they're only one version of the reality out there, and we can always tell a different story. So Caroline Lucas tells the story of people as fundamentally generous and caring about each other. And the more we hear that story, the more it may become a self-fulfilling prophecy and we may become like that.
Mm. But also maybe, I suppose you're implying there as well, that actually drawing attention to the narrative nature of a lot of these things themselves, actually saying this is a story, is part of that process. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's fundamentally key. And this is key for all kinds of critical language awareness, that a particular version of reality that is common within the culture is just a story. It is just one version and other versions are possible. And sometimes you can resist entrenched and ingrained stories with actual narratives, actual stories of the kind that, you know, you tell to children and that are in novels, are real stories. So I have an example of that. And This is Rachel Carson, who wrote the book Silent Spring. And the book Silent Spring starts with two pages called A Fable for Tomorrow. And this was written as a story. And this story is what's credited with actually starting the whole environmental movement. So A Fable for Tomorrow starts like this. There once was a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. Deer silently crossed the fields, half hidden in the mists of autumn mornings. Even in winter, the roadsides were places of beauty. And so this story begins, like many stories do, with harmony and equilibrium. But then something comes to disrupt that harmony, disrupt the equilibrium. And this is the next stage, which is degeneration. So it is a strange blight crept over the area. Some evil spell had settled on the community. Mysterious maladies swept the flock of chickens. Everywhere was a shadow of death. And the few birds seen anywhere were moribund. It was a spring without voices. And this is the title of the book is Silent Spring, which is a spring where the birds are not singing because of the environmental destruction. So she's structured this as an apocalyptic narrative, and she's given all these hints that it's supernatural, it's an evil spell, it's mysterious maladies, it's a shadow of death. But then right at the end, she says, no witchcraft, no enemy action had silenced the rebirth of new life in this stricken world. The people had done it to themselves. And this is the great power of this, that she's pointing out that human action can have this devastating impact on the world. And Silent Spring led to some real changes in policy, as particularly around pesticide use, and had a very large impact on the world. And you can't see that now because everything is so totally in such a terrible collapsing state, but it would have been far worse without Rachel Carson's work. But in general, this is an example of how an actual story can be used to change the fundamental stories of the society around us, those kind of deeper narratives. So there's the power of actual narratives to affect change.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I was listening to a talk you did where you talked about other stories in other cultures. And, you know, you've used the word culture just earlier. And you were talking about Bhutan and the measurement of, instead of growth, the measurement of happiness and how happy society is. And that just seems to me an amazing thing that you could look at what we have, you know, and what we've already got that's making us happy instead of all the time looking for a perceived lack.
Exactly.
Are these things that give us hope that there are these stories out there?
Well, and I think that's a very important point to make, is that we're not just critiquing these destructive stories. We're also looking to cultures around the world in the search for new stories to live by. So in Bhutan, they ditched the idea of gross national product, which is just a measure of how much money changes hands between people, and instead talk about gross national happiness. And so just orientating the whole society towards making people happy. But it's not a selfish kind of happiness. They redefine the notion of happiness as a more generous kind of community where people look after each other's needs and the needs of nature. So that's how they kind of redefine happiness.
How amazing would that be?
Yes, certainly. There's so many wonderful ideas in the world out there. We need to be exploring them and searching for positive new stories to live by.
Yeah. And I think as well, you mentioned at the end of talking about the Rachel Carson Silent Spring thing, the sort of focus on people doing it to themselves. What about that kind of idea that, you know, the focus on individual behaviour as a kind of person in a wider society is perhaps less important than focusing on the systems that people are part of? What do you make of that sort of dichotomy between the individual and the system and the different sort of focuses there might be?
Oh, that's absolutely right. And the fossil fuel industry is very keen to blame individual people for the things that we're seeing in the world. Mm-hmm. So we've got ecosystem collapse, and then they're trying to make it out that it's individual people's carbon footprints and people should be recycling more and buying a Prius. That's nothing to do with these huge global problems. So that's why we have to get to the heart of the systems. And to do that, that's why we're looking at stories.
Yeah.
Stories that the whole system is based on. So it's got to get down to the heart and change the whole way that the world works. Now, that sounds quite optimistic because transnational capitalism seems so entrenched and embedded that you can't imagine it ever changing. And some people say it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And I can see that kind of point. We're in an unsustainable civilization, and there's only two possibilities: either that civilization changes or it collapses. And to be honest, I think we're much more likely to be heading towards collapse. But as society collapses, that's the point where we need these new stories to live by. So that's the point where we can get some reception for different ways of doing things, when we really realize that actually that path wasn't such a great path and has led to this destruction, and let's search for new paths. So I see the search for new stories to live by as being essential, whether we're heading towards collapse or whether we're heading for transformation.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting to sort of think about that sort of bigger picture, you know, the story picture, as you put it, and the stories we live by. What about on a more, I guess, a more, maybe not granular, but certainly a more lexical kind of focus, where when you look at some of the kind of vocabulary choices that are made by people, groups, systems, institutions to describe what's happening to us. So things like, you know, do we talk about the phrase global warming, or do we say global heating? Climate change, climate emergency, climate collapse. Where do you stand on how those terms are used and how important they are?
I think you have to be a bit careful not to say this term is bad, we must use this term, because different terms have different connotations and have different uses in different situations. So sometimes climate change may be the most useful thing to use in the situation. Sometimes you may want to point out it's not just that the climate is changing, but the climate is changing with a devastating effect on people, which is why you might talk about climate catastrophe. But it would be very odd if you said that ministers are gathering to discuss climate catastrophe in Egypt.
Yeah.
If you just insisted on, I've got to use this word all the time, then you can end up with some fairly strange things. And sometimes it's useful not just to think about the words, but to think about framing and how climate change is framed. So I have some examples of this. So Caroline Lucas, again, she says, instead of treating the climate crisis as an environmental issue, we need to reframe it as the overwhelming threat to national and global security, which it is. So we can think of climate change as an environmental issue, which for most people, that's something that is in the distant future. It's something that needs to be addressed through recycling. And it's something that policymakers need to deal with, or we need to deal with it individually in these little changes. Whereas if it's a threat to national security, then that makes it much more urgent and immediate. And the people who need to deal with this are not just the government, but also the military, and everyone in society needs to focus on this threat. This is a kind of a framing. And there's many different ways you can frame climate change. So Rebecca Solnit says, climate change is global scale violence against places and species, as well as against human beings. So this is framing climate change as violence. And if you're framing it as violence, then there must be a perpetrator of the violence.
Right.
And that is us. This is the high consuming countries that are causing climate change, are being represented as perpetrators of violence. And the victims of the violence are other places and species and humans in vulnerable countries. So if we're represented as a perpetrator doing this immoral thing, then that might encourage us to do something about it. So this is about how it's framed. And framing can also be metaphorical. So you could metaphorically call climate change a time bomb. Metaphors always have advantages and disadvantages. A time bomb is something quite serious that you need to defuse quickly. But it also has a disadvantage, because once the bomb's gone off, then there's nothing to do. Whereas with climate change, whatever happens, you've still got a lot of things you can do in mitigation and adaptation to try and make the most of life in a hotter world. And there's all kinds of metaphors as well. There's hot houses, greenhouses, atmospheric blankets, sinks, drains, flipped and flickering switches, conveyor belts, roller coasters, even bungee jumpers attached to speeding roller coasters.
They're brilliant.
Not a ride.
Great,
I
isn't it? So all kinds of metaphors, and you can look at them at the advantages and disadvantages of them.
The idea of like greenwashing that we've sort of mm-hmm. come across. I mean, is that the sort of concept that some companies, organizations want to kind of almost sort of launder their green credentials, or rather the other way, isn't it? It's they want to launder their, you know, anti-green policies as being green in some way. And, you know, there are a lot of companies who try to represent themselves through language as being ecologically sound, ecologically aware. How can we be a bit more critical of the sort of language used in those situations?
Yeah, so greenwashing is definitely a real issue. And in a way, it's quite good when companies are coming forward and talking about green policies, because then we can challenge them on them. And at least those policies are coming to light. But then if people think that, you know, buying a slightly more efficient car is actively saving the planet, then that becomes a serious issue. And I'm quite concerned with cause marketing. And so cause marketing is when a company suddenly takes up a position, let's say against racism, and then its advertisements are all kind of about anti-racism. And that distracts attention away from the ethics of the company. So Coca-Cola recently produced an advertisement where they got George the Poet, who's radical performance poet, to produce an advertisement about emerging from the pandemic in, you know, a positive way, and we're going to dance and we're going to do all these things that we couldn't do before, and we're all going to have better lives. And it's really feel-good advertisement called Open Like Never Before, with that open being kind of a metaphor for opening the bottle. And then when you look at it, there's all these product placements in the advertisement. So you have these two families during lockdown, and they're outside in their gardens, and they holding up a bottle of Coke over the fence to like connect each other. So they're associating Coca-Cola with this connection between people in the pandemic. And of course, this was a time when people who were obese were suffering much more. People who had diabetes were suffering much more from coronavirus. And the dentists weren't open, so people whose teeth were being, you know, damaged by the Coca-Cola. And it's just like, we're such an ethical company, and we, you know, we're trying to help you to emerge positively from the pandemic while pushing products on you that are ecologically destructive. And Coca-Cola is the number one company in the world for plastic pollution. And so this cause marketing does worry me. And then they say that this wasn't about selling our product. This is about Coca-Cola's mission, which is to benefit the world.
Right.
Very sneaky.
I wonder what the people who work in some of their factories and some of the been affected by some of their policies in developing countries would say to that.
So picking up on this idea of different narratives in different cultures, different stories being told, can you tell us a little bit more about Indigenous cultures, ideas and stories that we could be looking to replace some of the quite unfortunate framing that we've got used to?
Yeah, certainly. So I haven't been sleeping very well. So I've been listening to podcasts for the first time ever. And I've actually got quite addicted to them, because with podcasts, you can hear the voices of people that you wouldn't usually hear. And there are a lot of podcasts where Indigenous elders and leaders from around the world are expressing their vision of reality. And because it's a podcast, they're doing it in a way that is personal and very authentic. So I've been really enjoying listening to these and then drawing out from that some positive new stories to live by. So one of these leaders is called Rowan White, and she's a seed keeper from the Native American Mohawk community. And in one of these podcasts, she says, looking at this modern world and who I was as a Mohawk woman, the foods and seeds really helped me to reclaim a sense of identity and find my way home, to find that purpose, and help me to restore a sense of connectedness, a restoring of my life through food and seed. So I find this deeply meaningful, this idea of restoring a life. So she grew up quite disconnected from her traditional culture, but she went and she talked with her elders and she found out everything she could about Mohawk culture. And she discovered this deep connection with nature and the deep connection through food that comes from the heritage seeds. And she used that to kind of redefine herself as a person. So she became a seed keeper. And the way that she talks about the natural world really embodies this sense of connectedness. So she says, the seeds teach us to be generous and to share our abundance with other people. So this is representing seeds as active agents of the verb teach. So the seeds are doing things and teaching us things and giving us messages. And we're learning from the natural world, not about competition, the struggle for survival that is always in the David Attenborough documentaries, but the abundance in nature and the generosity in nature, where plants will share their seeds widely with other animals, and they gain and the animals gain. She said things like, the energy that is inside a seed, it's the same essence that grew you in your mother's womb. It's the same life force. So she's using language here to tell a story that humans and seeds are identical along the plane of life. And of course, if we see ourselves as identical with nature, then we're going to be protecting nature and caring about nature. So this is drawing from indigenous ways of seeing the world for new stories that we can live by in this world.
And you mentioned that the phrase, you know, stories we live by, there's a website. Tell us more about the Stories We Live By website.
Yeah, certainly. So this is a free online course that I developed. I got my students involved, actually, and we developed this together. And it goes through framings and metaphors and identities and all of this different kind of theory that can be used for analyzing texts. And then it applies them to this great range of texts, from economics textbooks to haiku poetry, this vast range of negative texts which are putting our civilization on a path towards ecological destruction, and positive texts from around the world that can give us a new way of thinking. So I would recommend this free course for A-level students, because all of those things like framing and appraisal patterns and identity, you can use them for analyzing any kind of texts, literary texts, non-literary texts.
Sounds brilliant. Yeah. Really helpful, particularly for language investigations and projects that students do on the A-level. That'd be really, really helpful.
Yeah. So if you just type Stories We Live By into Google, then you can find it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll share that in the show notes so people can have a look at that. Mm-hmm. Right. So, Aaron, what's your favourite book about language?
Well, there's a book that really inspired me. It's called The Spell of the Sensuous by David Abram. And in this book, he says that in traditional oral cultures, language is something which brought us closer to nature, because the words in the language describe things that were out there in the environment around us, the very real things in the environment around us. But with the invention of writing, then we started to talk about things and write about things from other ecosystems, other times, other places. And there was a lot of abstractions. So you can see that in economics, where people are buying and selling derivatives, which don't actually bear any relationship to the world at all. Mm-hmm. And so with writing, we started to live in this artificial world of constructions that separated us from the natural world. And to do something about it, we need to write language back into the land. So we need to use language which evokes the spirit of the natural world around us. And the reason I like this book is because David Abram actually does that in his own writing.
That's amazing. What's your favorite linguistic fact or idea?
Well, I do like this idea of the stories we live by. Mm-hmm. And we've already talked about that. Mm-hmm. But this is a very powerful use of language that really engages people and gets them reflective about the society around them and the basis of the society around them, and orientates them towards finding new stories to live by.
So that brings us on to our last quick question. What one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist?
Well, I would say it's really important to do things that are real. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, linguists need to look at language and come up with theories of language and describe language and analyze language. But there needs to be a point. We don't have the luxury of just doing things for the sake of doing things. That we're in a terrible global situation where there are serious issues around us that need addressing, and linguistics can play a really key and important role in addressing those issues. So I would say always keep in the back of your mind, how can I use this for addressing some of the big issues that we're facing in the world today?
Mm. That's a fantastic way of framing it, that urgency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Cheers for giving up your time for doing it. It's really appreciated.
Sure. Cheers then.